this is like a revival tent. And by the way, you know, about the localism stuff, I grew up about a mile north of here, a mile and a half, three blocks behind Franklin High School. First one is abjectly sad political. Broken red clay pitchers. Kenetra, the emptied Syrian town of 25,000, then zero, a few miles behind the Golan Heights, 1970. I was hitchhiking. By the boarded upstairs to the minaret, I hold a broken red clay pitcher. It once held water as this small plain mosque once held the intangible. I wander through little concrete houses that once held, each clasps tight to tiny enclosed orchards front and back, holding ripe green plums, apples, grapes, a pomegranate tree. Tiny concrete houses still holding a feeling these people loved to live here. Okay, now, you know, I have a penchant for dismal. Oh, just one second. All right, I have a penchant for dismal love poems. And this one has three titles. It's Henrik Ibsen wrote his Wild Duck story about how people need the illusions they live by, but I didn't want to be hers, or second title. The relationship looked like it was headed for conflict, so I said, let's just be friends, and she said, okay, but the relationship didn't listen or didn't care if we were rolling around in the hay or not, because it was going to do what it was going to do, and so proceeded onto its inevitable conflicted end. Or third title. Modern poetry is defined by the intensive use of some poetic device. In this poem, rather than the run-on title, the poetic device is the run-on sentence. And here's the poem. I'm too close to my illusions about myself to be able to say just what I'm talking about, but I have an image of two foggily gray, unsolid, house-sized objects in fog, maybe each other's fog, maybe our own, maybe we value our fogs, maybe that's what determines that the fog sustains some damage when they collide, but what makes more sense is that we are two middle-aged, half-worn-out, nearly old persons somehow poured into moderately presentable skin sacks as if we are old apples preserved within 33-degree carbon dioxide storage facility monitored environments and exercise routines and skin creams till we look neonatal, waxy, shiny, appetizing, but when you bite into us, we still taste mushy. Still middle-aged persons holding up paintings of each other that look like mirrors, but showing how each of us wants to be seen from someone else's eyes, or we are the mirrors, or we only have one mirror between us, and we struggle over who has to hold it, only it shows nothing, so one or both of us have to dress up as how the other would like to see himself or herself, which would be okay if I wanted to play dress up or thought she could dress up in a way which would make me feel good, which I'm not immune to. If I needed that more or were hungry, I might do it, but I couldn't figure out that I wanted very much of what I could imagine her giving other than to talk sometimes, which is a gender stereotype role reversal, but it made conflict inevitable that I wasn't being who she needed me to be so she could be who she needed to be, which seemed to have an element of put up with me so I know I'm worth it. Not that I didn't have my own ways of something similar that I certainly wouldn't admit to, of course. until vague, foggy darkness rips apart to brightly expose two middle-aged people, shiny old mushy apples in the conflict of not wanting to be what we are or aren't, and that potentially most emotionally violent of all interpersonal conflicts, wherein and which forth and so by the aforementioned parties above designated as we failed all in all to make a successful mutual contract to support each other's illusions. Dead serious one here. The saliva glands in poet's hands. I don't mean to bounce his tennis ball off the tablecloth. It bounces to topsoil under a tomato plant where he snags it. I wrestle it from his jaw. The fuzz of this tennis ball, so gooed, saturated, coated with its colloidal mixture of dirt and saliva, that the tablecloth sports a dark, round, wet print. Well, it's an outdoor tablecloth at a backyard mojito party. But he's like all dog persons. Dogs use their lower jaws as opposable thumbs with which they can pick up a stick or a ball. So their mouths are like hands, but equipped with a lot of slobber. Poet's hands, though equipped with pores, which do occasionally exude sweat, sometimes making them hot and sticky as if lecherous, or cold and clammy as if dead. Poet's hands are more often dry, not even requiring, as was true with quills and inkwells, a sanding of the page to dry the ink. Poet's hands type or write with ballpoints or keyboards and printers whose ink dries almost instantly. So where does all the slobber come from? Okay. I'm keeping track of time here on my stopwatch.
Yeah, but you cheated. You started late.
What?
You cheated. You started late.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's fair. A heart yowling on a fence or just throw a shoe at it. Oh, no, my heart. No, I haven't seen it for a couple of weeks. No, I've long since ceased worrying about it. Oh, yes, of course, I did get tired of it scratching to be let out, but having the pre-med student down the block install a little swinging pet door in the ribs there on the left solved that problem. Hearts will do what they want, you know. Yes, I know they kill birds. Sometimes it leaves the remains just inside the front door so that every time I cough, I blow feathers. Or it brings me a rat or a mouse, usually dead, but the side effect of that is just a little indigestion. No, as I said, I haven't seen it for a while. Yeah, I got a couple complaints from the neighbors down on Ingenue Street that it was sitting on an alley fence, yowling love dubs all night at something down there. I told them, just throw a shoe at it. But it comes back every once in a while, probably just for the kibbles and bits. I'm not sure it feels any real loyalty to me. A bit scratched up from all the fights. You know how alley cats, alley hearts are. Gives as good as it gets, probably. No, again, I'm not worried. The vet said it's a scrappy sort of heart. And as long as it beats or gets beaten, it doesn't really matter if it's in my chest or off sniffing the aorta of some overly estrosized female. You know what they say, that to a heart in heat, a ventricle's orifice smells good. No, you can't control the damned things. It's not like they'll tolerate a leash, as if anyone even tries outside of fundamentalists. And inside of fundamentalists, it's all circus cages and trainers with whips and burning rings of fire and the sneering lady with the cat's eye glasses before you even get to the freak show and the house of horrors and the Siamese hearts and the geek heart that bites the heads off chickens, which all sounded like just a fine idea and great fun a long time ago, except the silly fundamentalists thought my heart didn't have the aptitude for efficient training. They tried. They could get it to roll over, but they couldn't make it learn to play dead. Bother. Well, I could have had it fixed. Maybe I should have. Would have stopped it from spraying on the furniture. But I figure if you're going to have a male heart, you just have to wash a little blood off the couch leg every once in a while, over there by the pancreas, and swat it and rub its nose in it till it half learns to go outside, mostly. Too late now, anyway. Too bad. Lots of people have castrated hearts and seem to have quite peaceful lives. But they say if you're going to castrate them, you have to do it while they're young, before they learn bad habits, like the aforementioned yowling love doves on some alley fence to some ventricle in heat. Thank you. Okay, you know, okay, one old favorite, a cameo for Uma Thurman's feet. A young tanguera, I danced tango for the last 20 some years, a young tanguera tells me any movie in which a woman kicks butt is a good movie. She's actually an international star by now. So I take my brain-injured brother to see Uma Thurman. Yes, she plays a blonde female in a samurai movie with a spaghetti western music, but it's her feet, or the middle and big toes. I'm not sure of the identity boundaries between toes and feet, and I want to give them all credit so they don't get jealous. As I was saying, it's her feet in an uncredited appearance that get to me, till I deeply and meaningfully ponder that if her feet have a cameo, Uma Thurman must be the movie. This beautiful starlet, so groomed to such perfection, such loveliness, she is the stereotype constrained as if within a too tight shoe. By the rules of ingenue, leading lady heroine, every flaw and incompatible bit of character, except for her feet, chased from her till she is a picture moving. It is because we paint over lead actors' character with celluloid perfection that supporting actors, or arch-supporting actors, such as her feet, must supply character in movies such as Uma. Uma's feet gaining some independence from her due to transient paralysis of her character's unnaturally long legs propped up across the back seat of a yellow cab over truck on its sides painted with the words Pussy Wagon in the movie Kill Bill 2, or she is the movie, her feet in an uncredited appearance, supposedly supporting actors, though just here they won't, being all paralyzed or on some actor's strike. As she yells at them, come on feet, move! We watch the big toe of her right foot bunion inward at a totally unnatural angle of by years of high heel shoes with pointed toes, her middle toe, oh so long and gangly and crooked, squirming its way forward like it is a geriatric flipping its middle toe at all the people who molded the rest of her into such a feminine image. These are ugly feet, deformed feet, honest feet, feminist feet, feet shouting what we do to women to make them the way we want them. Not that I'm immune to that, nor I presume is my traumatically brain-injured brother, but such a character in an action movie, there should be Oscars for cameos, Oscars for great little performers in great little scenes in superb movies. as Uma Thurman, for example, her ugly, deformed feet. There should be a best arch supporting character actor Oscar for Uma Thurman's feet.